You're listening to the Cycling Podcast at the Vuelta a España in association with Rafa. Today we are in Les Prades de Nava.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Fran Reyes.
Hello, Richard. Hello, listeners.
Hello. We'll be joined soon by Daniel Freiba. We're on a noisy street in the center of Oviedo, hometown of Samuel Sanchez.
Yeah, there is a statue of...
Is it still there? Is it still standing?
Yes, it is.
Not
still
being torn down.
No, not at all. And he's still biting his gold medal from the Olympic Games, of which he speaks quite fondly every time he has a chance of.
Okay, well, I always like being here. It's a nice town, beautiful in a beautiful Asturias. Fran, I'm very keen to get on with the Tail of the Etapa because I'm worried that I'll forget how to pronounce the names I've just been practicing with you.
Yeah, we have been practicing long and hard, and I'm sure that you are going to do a good job. Really trust you, Richard.
Etapa 14, Cisterna. Cisterna to Les Prades de Nava, just outside the village of Nava.
Exactly, where we were. National Park. Yeah. Outside of Nava.
The stage was 171 kilometers long.
That's cheating.
The stage was 171 kilometers long. And what a thriller it served up. It was a great stage, really exciting. The climb at the end was a new climb for the Vuelta, still finding new climbs.
Yeah, I mean, indeed, there wasn't a road before the Vuelta came here. You know,
there was barely a road when the Vuelta did come here.
There was a gravel road. And since the Vuelta wanted to come here and the township wanted the Vuelta to come, they resurfaced it with some asphalt and a bit of,
We did mention this last night, didn't we? But yeah, slightly controversial, but one of these super, super steep climbs. We'll get on to the climb in due course. There were five climbs today. A strong break went once again, much smaller this time than it's been the last few days, but it made up in quality what it maybe lacked in quantity. The riders were Brent Buchwalter and Nicholas Roach from BMC, Ivan Garcia Cortina, the local man from Team Bahrain Merida, young rider. So is he 22 still, about that?
Yeah, I think he's 23 already, but well, he's still pretty young.
Young guy. Now, we stayed overnight in a hotel last night with an English father and son, and they had a photograph of Garcia Cortina doing a no-handed wheelie on the climb yesterday, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, he has that bit of an engine and also a great skills.
Great bike handling skills. So he was the other guy on the break. Quite a surprise to see him there because not really a stage for him today. He's quite a big guy. Also, there was Michal Kwiatkowski from Team Sky. Thomas De Gendt was there, of course. Of course he was there. And Michael Woods was there from EF Education First. So a strong group, strong riders, strong climbers, and you know the bunch didn't let them get too much of a lead. It all kind of kicked off, I suppose, on the Alto de la Mosqueta climb. Thomas De Gendt went over the top first. He is closing in on the King of the Mountains jersey that's been held for so long by Luis Angel Mate,
who is currently sick.
He's not looking good, as he had to be pushed along for a bit today. But De Gendt had a problem then. He shipped his chain and lost contact with the group and never got back on. But now the gap, which had been 3 or 4 minutes, was down to less than a minute and a half. They couldn't really afford to wait for De Gendt. They had to press on. The bunch was closing. On the descent, Michael Woods then had a problem. He crashed. He's had some bad luck at this Vuelta. He's quite bandaged up. So another fall for him. On the descent, Barry Morita really hit the front very, very hard, setting things up for Yoni Zagiri. Is he quite local? No, he's a Basque, isn't he?
Yes, he's Basque. He roots from maybe 200-300 kilometres from here.
Not that local then. But obviously they fancied Yoni Zagiri for today. Lots of splits in that group under that pressure from Bahrain Merida. Most of the favourites were in the front group, but Jesus Harada was dropped. He put up such a good defence of his red jersey, but he was distanced on the descent. George Bennett was also in trouble there. David De La Cruz also. They were both left behind with Harada and lost quite a lot of time in the end. There was one more Category 3 climb before the finish. By now, Michal Kwiatkowski was out on his own. The two BMC riders had also dropped back, and Kwiatkowski was hanging on. But it was all leading up to this final 4-kilometre climb. average, well, the average gradient apparently was 12.5%, but I think it was a lot more than that. It was plus 20% in lots of places.
Yeah, there were sections of 400 meters with more than 20% average. So, yeah.
Yeah, and again, it was one of those days where the road book said 2,910 meters of vertical gain. Actually, more like 3,500 meters of vertical gain, apparently. So, Kwiatkowski, I'd say, was the last man standing. He was swept up eventually, and it all came down to that big, steep climb up to the finish. And it was 4 kilometers long, but it seemed like about 20. I mean, it was a real grind, and Stephen Kruiswijk took it on quite early. He looked very good, got a bit of a gap at one point, but there was still a long way to go, even when, you know, he was two kilometers to go, still a long way to go. And the guy who we didn't see an awful lot of, he was doing the bare minimum, was Simon Yates. He seemed to be closing gaps when he absolutely had to, but he wasn't showing his hand too early at all. Nairo Quintana and Miguel Angel Lopez were both looking far more frisky and went off the front a couple of times, but seemed to be looking at each other. Quintana was looking a lot at Lopez to help him. They kept going away and coming back and going away and coming back. And in the end, there was one clinical attack by Simon Yates that won him the stage. So he is back in the red jersey of race leader. Alejandro Valverde is in the points jersey. Mate remains in the climbers jersey. Lopez is in the combined jersey. Barry Merida, best team. And Kwiatkowski won the combativity prize today.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to Rafa, our headline sponsor. We are extremely grateful to them. Another reminder, you might have just heard a voice in the background there. That was Daniel Freib screwing up his face at the what's just arrived. Daniel, yeah. not what you wanted.
Not what I wanted.
Oh dear, anyway. But a final shout, or maybe not a final shout, maybe we'll do another one for our Cycling Podcast Femina Women's 100 ride next Saturday the 15th. 100 kilometres, 2 cafe stops. Notice you being given a bit of a tough time on Twitter today again, Daniel. Rory Sutherland, no less, the UAE rider, confirmed that cafe stops are indeed acceptable in Spain.
If cafe stops are acceptable, can we at least eradicate cake stops, whatever they are.
Fair enough. Well, cake. Do you know what cakes are?
Yeah, I've vague recollection of having
sugary,
eaten one.
Sugary things.
In the late 80s. Yeah.
Go to rafa.cc, Women's 100, scroll down, you'll find the ride. So we have been joined by Daniel Freiba, so it's the three of us here. So today, I mean, I thought that was a really good stage today. Funny though, we're still, in a sense, none the wiser. That, you know, at one point it looked like it was almost a bunch sprint coming into the, you know, 6 or so riders, a lot of riders on a climb like that. Maybe there is a school of thought that these super steep climbs don't actually split it up as much as a long power climb like the kind that we're going to have tomorrow. But, you know, again, there's lots of skirmishing, lots of shadow boxing. It looked like Quintana and Lopez were the strongest for a lot of the climb, but they couldn't get the advantage that they needed. And in the end, Simon Yates played an absolute blinder. Is a handbrake finally off?
I think, Rich, it is. I mean, his whole demeanour was very different today from the way it had been when he'd taken the red jersey for the first time, which he felt was almost a bit of a hollow victory when he first had the red jersey. He didn't particularly want it. Hadn't gone looking for it. Whereas today, there was no doubt about it. He spied an opportunity and took it. As regards the climb itself, Les Playeres, I mean, driving up, I thought they'd gone a little bit. Javier Guillen has gone a little bit too far in terms of, well, obviously the Vuelta's identity has been based on these extremely steep, a lot of people in Spain refer to them as goat tracks. And it's worked for the race. It's really worked. And we've been some fantastic locations. However, today, you know, there were sections where, fortunately, there were a lot of fans. We haven't seen that many fans at the roadside in the Vuelta so far. And the sections with 25% gradient, gravel road, or, well, it was really a cement road, but which had not been cleaned, so it almost become like gravel. And I just thought that it was an accident waiting to happen. There were still cars going up there at 4:30, 5 o'clock. the riders, to their credit, the ones I spoke to didn't complain. I think they're used to it now. But this is all
crampons roped to the mountain.
Yeah, my reservations are compounded by the fact that once you get beyond the hype, and I think it's great, and I think it's a fundamental part of the spectacle now with major tours, and particularly the Vuelta, that for months even in advance of the route presentation, you get rumors about these spectacular, super steep, secret climbs that are going to be unveiled. And I think that's great. And it's great when they are unveiled and pundits go to ride them, and you know, they use all sorts of superlatives to talk about how fabulous and brilliant they're going to be. But very little of that is conveyed through television. A lot of people watching that today would have had no real idea just how extreme the slopes were. And you know, we don't really see attacks. We see riders sort of nudging ahead of each other, and then other riders nudging back. And I don't know, I just felt today that the Vuelta possibly needs to look at the next frontier. What is the next frontier in climbing and in terms of, you know, mountain stages? There is one that they've got very much sort of in mind, and that's to concentrate on altitude and to go to the Pico de Veleta in the Sierra Nevada, which is over 3,300 meters above sea level, for various reasons, including the wind. They haven't done it yet, but I just felt today that I had a bit of sort of goat track fatigue today.
Has it jumped the shark?
Yeah, a little bit. And as I say, there are great things about these finishes, and it was such a spectacular location. I just felt that the risk today, and there was a big risk of something going wrong, I felt anyway, was not really worth the reward.
Yeah, I mean, I thought that the jump of the shark was La Camperona, which is too steep, you know, and I didn't see the climb enjoyable. This one today was extreme, and I think we can go further than that, because this road has been created specifically for the Vuelta to pass. But I'm going to play devil's lawyer here and say that actually we didn't see fireworks today because there were attacks, but we saw a thriller, a 20-minute thriller that was quite entertaining. Everyone, I couldn't stop watching the stage. I was actually excited to see what the outcome was going to be. And
it was a bit like a tortoise race, wasn't it? You can imagine six tortoises sort of just nudging ahead a little bit and then coming back. And
yeah,
you know, it was such a crawl up there.
And what it definitely isn't is, once they get to the climb, it's tactical, or you could say it's a different kind of tactics. It's a psychological tactic. It's a tactic of managing effort. It's not really a strategic tactic of where am I going to place my attack? How is my team going to contribute to that? But it is tactical nonetheless, as I say, in a physiological sense. And it was interesting how some guys got it wrong today. Like Kreiswijk, I think, got it wrong. There was no need to attack as early as he did. I think he's very strong. I think he's going to contend to win this Vuelta, but he got it slightly wrong today. And Yates was the one who got it absolutely right. I'm not sure exactly, because there were a few sections on the climb where the road did really flatten out. I mean, only 100, 200 meters at a time. I'm not sure exactly where he went and how premeditated it was. I don't think it was premeditated, but it really stuck.
He was a sniper today, wasn't he? He had one bullet, and as I say, Quintana and Lopez had looked so good. There was one moment where they really did get a big gap, but I think it was where the road kind of flattened out a bit, and they got up behind a couple of motorbikes, and I think that bears out the point you're making, Daniel. There was a lot of congestion, and there was a moment where there was a TV motorbike and a photographer's motorbike, and they were far enough ahead at the pace they were going. Then they sped up, and they went right up behind them, and you know, it was a case where the motorbikes interfered with the race, either in offering shelter or in actually blocking them. Richie Porte had something to say about motorbikes today. Let's hear what he said this morning.
For me, today is more about survival. I had a hard day yesterday, as most of us did. The TV motorbikes here are a disgrace. They're way too close to the peloton. It's making it so much harder to race. But, you know, what can we do? We complain to the commissaires and nothing's done. But it's really disappointing that that's what's shaping this race. They're so close. If people on television are looking at television at home, see guys waving their arms in the peloton, normally that's because the TV motorbike's so close. And yesterday, all day. It was just so, so close, and it made for a super hard day.
So that was Richie Port, who just feels that, well, a lot of people have been talking about this. Jonathan Vaught has told us at the Tour that he thinks the interference of motorbikes in bike racing is one of the great scandals that's not really spoken about. The fact that it does have an impact on the racing, and Richie Port clearly thinks it's particularly bad at the Vuelta.
I mean, I agree, Rich. Well, like, you can only, you know, we're not in the peloton, we can only listen to and pay heed to what the guys who are riding say about this, and they're increasingly vociferous about it. However, I would caveat that by saying go back and look at some clips from the 90s.
The 80s.
Yeah, if you go back and particularly the Italian races, Milan San Remo in the mid-90s is just an absolute circus. As soon as someone attacked on the Poggio, they were in a swarm of maybe 12 motorbikes. And, you know, it's no surprise that the climbing times on the Poggio have not advanced much beyond the late 90s. I mean, we know there are other reasons, but yeah. So I think things are better than they were. But, you know, in an age of marginal gains when riders are looking to trim off grams, and there's no doubt that a bit more shelter behind a motorbike is going to make a big difference.
No,
yeah, I mean, it's even with helicopters. You know, I've heard 100 tales about the influence of helicopters, particularly in the Giro d'Italia.
Tony Galopin was complaining about that today. The helicopters creating what was effectively a headwind on the final climb.
Yeah.
Fran, I asked whether the Vuelta jumped the shark. We saw the shark today in action for Barry Merida. He was quite prominent in helping to try and set things up for Jon Izagirre. You went at the finish and spoke to Jon Izagirre. Shall we hear from him now?
We can, of course.
Bueno, sabemos que la bajada era difícil y bueno, hemos decidido anticiparnos y
we knew the descent was tricky, so we decided to have a go. We created some gaps and decided to keep it going until the bottom of the final climb. I couldn't help the pace of those main GC guys there, but we did our best. I didn't feel great on the last climb, same as yesterday. These are quite punchy climbs where riders like Nairo, Yates, Pino, Lopez and Valverde thrive because of that kind of power. Anyway, I'm happy because we did our best and played our cards.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport.
Beta Fuel, the new super fuel from Science in Sport, is a 2-to-1 maltodextrin to fructose isotonic drink that delivers 80 grams of carbohydrates per serving without upsetting your stomach. This formulation means your stomach can process more carbohydrates per hour than glucose alone would allow. And this could make all the difference to your ride, whether you're cresting the Alpe d'Huez or just crossing the line at your local sportive. Available on scienceinsport.com from July the 12th.
Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science of Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. And a reminder, you can get 25% off at scienceofsport.com with the code SISCP25. Before the Science of Sport message, we heard from Jon Izagirre. Didn't quite work out for him, but they had an impact on the race. I mean, it was good to see, as he told us, they identified the descent as an opportunity for them as a team. They've got good descenders, good bike handlers, not least Nibali himself. They had Garcia Cortina in the break, presumably with a view to him maybe being still up the road when they launched this offensive on these descents. But yeah, good to see a team, you know, using the course in the way that they did and taking it on. It didn't work out for them in the end, but I thought it was a brave tactic.
I'd say that it kind of worked out. I mean, from a point of view, Izagirre didn't seem upset at all about having lost that much time. He's aware that this is not the type of climb where he thrives. He knows that he's more of a steady climber, so it was good for him. Yet, as you say, it's so great to see teams seizing the opportunity and knowing that if they have 8 riders in the race, is to use them all. That's something that Mitchelton Scott has done quite well over the years. And I see more and more teams jumping on that boat and using the resources they have.
Sensibly. Daniel Garcia Cortina mentioned his no-handed wheelie earlier on. You said you had a conversation with him about cider this morning.
He's actually from Gijón, which is just down the road from Oviedo, but that's less well known for cider production than Oviedo. I think I'm right in saying, Fran, Gijón is not as much of a cider producing town, but it's the same area. Anyway, Nava, the village at the bottom of the climb today, is certainly well known for its cider. And I had a chat with Ivan Cortina about that. That sounds like I'm about to introduce a fantastic soliloquy by Ivan Cortina about cider making in Asturias. I'm not. I'm just going to quite poorly paraphrase what he said to me. He said he enjoys cider. We discussed the nuances or the art of pouring cider in this part of the world, which is an art in itself, isn't it, Fran? You have to pour the cider from as high as possible above the glass. He explained that it's something to do with the cider breaking the surface of the drink and the glass, which I presume is to do with oxygenation. I'm not sure. And Rich, I remember. I don't know whether you were here. I think we stayed in Oviedo a year or two ago on the Vuelta, and we enjoyed some cider, didn't we? Poured in that exact fashion, and we will no doubt enjoy some more this evening.
I think it was.
It was
here.
Just down the road from here, in fact.
Daniel, yeah, I believe so. Was there not a rest day here last year?
Maybe.
And were Team Sky not just sitting around the corner from here?
Anyway. I do remember Lionel Verney last year after our cachopo dinner, enjoying a bottle of cider with a hoodie on. You know, it was quite an interesting picture to have in mind.
What else do we take away from today? I mean, we're looking ahead to tomorrow. We looked ahead to tomorrow yesterday, rather weirdly, but it was so kind of bizarre to see so many riders, six riders, coming together up that climb. And you think there's still very little to separate these
guys. Well, there's still 10 riders. Well, I think Emmanuel Buchmann is now 10th on.
Two minutes eight down.
So
the only rider fading, isn't he?
But the only rider who's actually definitively been guillotined this on these 2 days is George Bennett.
George Bennett,
who's had a bit of a hard time.
I mean, Pino was there as well. Pino's looking pretty good. He's got a lot of time to make up. But he's looking pretty good. You know, you feel that Uran is hanging on. Kreuzwick's got a bit more to give. Enric Mas looked good today as well, I thought.
Yeah, but this Enric Mas is a quite light rider who loves this sharp time. So both yesterday and today, he was impressive. I mean, among the five most powerful riders. But I will expect him not to be at that level tomorrow and in the coming days when the climbs got longer.
I asked Yates, Rich, at the finish, and didn't get a particularly detailed answer, but about the mental difference now between the position he's in and the position he was in at the Giro, where you pointed out on numerous occasions during the Giro that the time trial and the spectre of Tom Dumoulin was kind of a sword of Damocles above his head, and it felt as though all of his energies and all of his focus was going towards that time trial. He was thinking how much time he needed to gain. Obviously, you can never know exactly how much. Whereas here, he's got this smorgasbord of GC contenders in the top 10, pretty much all of which have got very mixed records in time trials. Someone like Rigoberto Urán, who's been fantastic in time trials at times in his career and pretty average in others. And it's very difficult to draw up a theoretical hierarchy of time trialing among those top 10. Bearing in mind that it's only 32 kilometers we've got in Torre la Vega in a few days. It's fairly flat, isn't it, Fran? It's not terribly hilly. But someone like Kreuzweig, you would think would probably gain time, a bit of time on Yates. I look back at the results of the Tour de France time trial over a similar distance, the last time trial in the Tour de France over a hilly course, and he was beaten that day by Adam Yates, who is not a particularly great time trial.
Trial that day, and Simon Yates is a decent time trialist. We can no longer say that when Simon Yates does a good time trial that he's somehow defied his lack of time trial prowess, because actually he's a really good time trialist, and that goes all the way back even to the Dusseldorf in the Tour de France last year, where he did a good time trial, and he's a you know, him and Quintana are actually good time trialists for the type of rider they look to be.
Fran, what about Valverde in a time trial? I mean, Valverde's he's won time trials, hasn't he, in his career?
I mean, he's been a Spanish national time trial champion. Yeah.
So, if there is a rider who is in genuine contention at the moment of winning, I'm not even talking about top 10, I'm talking about top 6, who might gain a minute on, or a minute or more on guys like Yates and Quintana, it could be Valverde, couldn't it?
Yeah, but even Miguel Angel Lopez has done some good time trials. It's really hard to assess who has a better chance. But by the way, chaps, what do you make out of the climb that Miguel Angel Lopez and Nairo Quintana did today?
I was gonna ask. I mean, it did look like they were cancelling each other out, didn't it? It looked like they were just Quintana especially seemed too worried about Lopez to really commit to the effort that he was making. I mean, it's easy to say that, but I don't know. What do you think?
I'm more intrigued by, and I think Fran will be able to give us some insight on this, what's the dynamic between those two? Because the geography of the Colombian cycling scene and all of the dynamics, who's friends with who and what kind of who has what kind of character, it's quite complex. And so Quintana versus Miguel Angel Lopez, what's going on there?
Well, I think we saw quite clear today that there is some kind of rivalry going on. I mean, neither of them talk about the other with a particular kindness, which is something that more or less fit both characters.
Because Superman is a superhero, obviously, and Quintana is like he's a deity in Colombia. Yeah. I mean, who wins?
Superman's got a great advantage at the top of these climbs because most of the riders have to get a whistle and ride back down and brave
down.
The crowd. He just dons a cape and flies back down to the team bus.
Incredible.
Remarkable to see.
Oh, boy.
Well, I mean, talking about the serious stuff, it was clear today that there is some kind of rivalry. Clearly, there is no sympathy with them, especially, I mean, it's no secret that Nairo Quintana doesn't have a lot of friends in the peloton and doesn't bear a lot of sympathy with anyone pretty much in the bunch, especially among his rivals. So yeah, and today he had the chance of actually showing all his strength, because he clearly, I think, is the rider with the best legs in this Vuelta a España. Yet instead of being worried of showing that and putting some time between him and the rest, he was more worried of not getting Lopez on his wheel.
But I think there's a fragility to Quintana, mental fragility to Quintana, and we've seen it. And even a couple of years ago at Lagos de Covadonga, where he won, Chris Froome was dropped quite near the bottom of that climb. I remember Froome was coming back and closing on Quintana, and Quintana was really not happy at the finish at how little time he'd taken from Froome. He was looking over his shoulder, literally and metaphorically, a lot. I wondered at the time whether it was just Froome had this hold on him, this kind of psychological hold on him. Yeah. But I think we saw it today with Lopez as well, that
Superman.
We saw it with Superman Lopez today, that Quintana seems far too concerned about other riders around about him, and I don't know. Maybe he'll take a minute tomorrow.
Talking about being concerned with other riders, I had an interesting conversation at the start this morning with Superman's teammate Dario Cataldo, who's a bit of a veteran now. He's ridden with some very good riders at Mountain Domestique, and he was talking about the difference in leadership styles between Nibali and Superman, and Nibali, he said, was the kind of captain who, for maybe 70% of a stage race, would not ask you for anything, would not need anything, would not want you to do anything, whereas Superman needs the whole team to be switched on and basically sort of chaperoning him at all times, telling him what to do.
High maintenance.
Quite high maintenance, but not in... I don't think in... You're not as a diva, but someone who is not that experienced. I think he took up cycling quite late and is just quite naive, and also is probably quite deferential to all of the experience he's got in that team, because Cataldo has done He's probably done over a dozen Grand Tours, and he's got guys like Peo Bilbao, and he's certainly relying a lot on those guys to tell him basically how to move in the peloton before he's left on his own on the final climb.
Exactly. You know, there is this feel in Astana, you know, this comment I've gotten several times from teammates of Miguel Angel Lopez. They are always taking care of him, looking after him, and sometimes they have to look behind to realize that he's not anymore in their wheel, because he is not really skilled when it comes to ride on the peloton, and that costs him a lot of energy he has to spend in order just to keep the wheel of his teammates. It's a quite big limitation, and when he overcomes that, he's going to be even more powerful of the climbs.
I waited at Team Sky bus at the finish to speak to Michał Kwiatkowski, but waited for a long time, and when he came back to the bus, he was not in the mood to stop even for a minute, which was a shame, because he really did, he made today's stage very exciting. You can tell that the riders, they're still kind of concerned about him, clearly. They don't want to give him too much rope. But the way that he then persisted on his own, there are very few riders in the world, I think, who could have done that with the chase that was happening behind. He's such a talented rider, and you know, I think he's using this Vuelta to prepare for the World Championship.
Do you think he went into this Vuelta? I got the impression he was going into this Vuelta with an open mind as to whether he might yet become a Grand Tour rider. And I think that as the days have gone by, it's dawned on him that it's more powerful than him. He cannot really alter his physiology to become a Grand Tour rider.
I think that's part of it. And I think also today he was actually annoyed that it didn't come off for him, that he wasn't able to win the stage. I think he wasn't, you know, he wasn't after the combativity prize, was he? So, he wasn't very happy. Yeah, I mean, he's still 20th overall, but you know, 9 minutes down. But yeah, you're right, Daniel. He's not one of the guys, you know, in that we're seeing among the top guys on the climbs day after day.
I think we shouldn't make too many assumptions about the future of Michał Kwiatkowski based on this Grand Tour. After all, he comes from a very long season. He didn't have the proper rest between the Tour de France and the Vuelta a España because, of course, he went to Tour de Poland for victory. So I think, the first week could quite well spur his ambitions of Grand Tour leadership in the future. I think if the next year they bring him to the Giro before making the effort of helping out Froome in the Tour de France, Froome or Thomas or Bernal maybe, we could learn more about his capacity of winning a Grand Tour there.
All valid points, Fran, but still no excuse for giving me the brush off at the bus today. Won't be forgotten in a hurry. One Team Sky rider who did speak to me, though, was Pavel Sivakov, who abandoned today, unfortunately, the 21-year-old Russian rider. But he's a very, very interesting talent, and this has been his debut Grand Tour. I spoke to him at the start, and I spoke to Nicolas Portal a couple of days ago about him, because Portal's from the same area, and he kind of talent spotted him, although, you know, all you needed to do was see some
have
of his
internet.
Results.
Have yeah, the internet. Basically have yeah. a reasonable broadband he, connection.
He's a very talented rider. So I've been keen to follow his progress. Unfortunately, his Vuelta came to an end today, but I thought we'd hear from him anyway, just because I think he's going to be a big rider in the future. So we're going to hear from Nicolas Portal, from Sivakov himself before the stage, and then I spoke to him briefly after the stage, well, after he'd abandoned. Pavel is someone you know well, isn't he, and someone you've followed for a long time, so I guess you're taking a special interest in him here.
Yes, exactly. I mean, he's come from my area in Southwest, so I know him from a long time, and I was pretty proud in a way that he signed for us with us, and it's good. Yeah, I think he's a big talent, so we're super happy to have him with us. Yeah, he's a tall guy, a big guy. I don't know exactly what I mean in English, but I think he's the one. You know, for the big picture, you can see he could develop himself as a big GC guy, like have a big, big ambition on a 3 weeks race. He's fast on a TT. Fast on a big mountain. He's not gonna climb maybe like a pure climber, but to drop him, you need to be, or for this age, you need to be like one of the best climber in the world. So for the overall, he got everything. He know how to fight. He's good for handling his bike. What is making him special, obviously, is his recovery. It's quicker. It's like a gun. Those guys, they can do 3-4 hard days and hope they recover pretty fast compared to the guys. So you've got this full package, and also someone calm, and obviously you come from this family, you got this history, you know, for cycling. So yeah, it's got some really good hope, you know.
How's your first Grand Tour going?
It's going like not the best way, like not like I wished. It went like the beginning was pretty okay until my crash, was fine. But now, yeah, I'm struggling every day, you know, with the crash and everything. Also, before to come here, I didn't have the best preparation, so I wanted to use the first week, you know, to get in. In Poland, actually, I cut my ankle rolling on a bottle of glass, and then it got infected, so I spent like 2 days in hospital and like 5 days off the bike, so the shape was not really great when I came here, but I used the first week and build it up, and like the last day of the first week just crash, and now struggling a bit to get on. Like now it's surviving mode until the rest day. Hope I can make it.
You're covered in bandages. I mean, how are your wounds? Are they healing? Do you feel yourself getting a little bit better each day?
Yeah, the wounds are healing well, but I mean the recovery is, you know, the recovery of the legs is not going really really well like I wished. Let's see how it goes. I hope. Didn't have a super night last night, but yeah, tough days, you know, with everything, like it's like layers put on, and it's not the best for me, but I'm not gonna like stop or something, just gonna fight.
Tell me briefly, you've got a very interesting background. Your parents were both cyclists, weren't they? You were born in Italy, I think, grew up in France. How many languages do you speak?
Yeah, exactly. I'm born in Italy, grew up in France, parents cyclists, both Russians. At home I speak Russian. Then obviously, like, I grew up in France, I did all my studies, school in France, so that's two languages, then English. And yeah, I would say a little bit of Spanish, but that's not my best one.
It was written in the stars, I suppose, that you would become a cyclist. When did you become a cyclist?
From my childhood, you know, everything was about cycling and family talking about cycling, but I didn't want straight to cycling. Practiced a few different sports before, and then I think about 12, 13 years old, I started racing. Straight away, I could feel that that's the sport, you know, I'm good at, not like the other ones.
You're quite a big guy, you're a big frame, but you won the Baby Giro. Nico says you're a future GC rider in a race like this, perhaps. Is that how you would like to see your career develop?
Yeah, exactly. Last year I won the Baby Giro, also Giro della Valle d'Aosta, which is even more climbing races. It's just climbing every day. If I got like all the GC riders now, it's more like tall, big guys, you know, just really lean and like riding tempo, and I think that's pretty much what I want to do in the future, you know, just work on that, but obviously also discover a bit of everything, the classics and everything. I think I would like to be a GC rider, but I want to discover everything.
Obviously this is all about learning for you this year and this race, but how difficult is it to go from being one of the winners in the under 23 ranks to almost going back to school in a way and getting used to not winning and playing a completely different role and races going in a completely different way?
Yeah, in the beginning it's a bit hard to accept, you know, you're like, oh, I'm dropped. You look back, you're full gas, you look back, the whole peloton is still there, and you're like, oh. But then now you know, you're accepting it, and you're like, okay, I just take my time, no rush, I'm only 21 years old. It's even better, you know, when you think about it, easy when you come down to just take your time. Like if you look, the best guys who went to the top, they were never really, really good, like really young. They just kind of build up this and then reach the top a bit later on. I'm just, you know, trying to learn how I accept it, just hanging on, learning, yeah, training.
Bad night last night, and it just, today was too much, was it?
Yeah, it was just, the day is so bad so far in my career, you know, just start and I could feel straight away that the heart rate was not just rising and the legs were just like wood. And in the first kick was just nothing, you know. Normally this kick is just like easy for me, and there I was already dropping from the bunch. So I understood immediately that I'm not gonna make it today. And I thought, yeah, so the first extra feed we had, I think was kilometer 30, just stop and yeah, what do I...
Not a good day to have a bad day.
No, not a good day to have a bad day. I think on the Vuelta here, it's not a good, never is a good day to have a bad day. But no, just the body today was a bit too much for me, and never really recovered from that crash. And yeah, it's like that. I'm 21 years old, so.
You've had some bad luck, but what's the biggest lesson? What's the biggest thing you take away from this Vuelta?
Yeah, I think it's really to manage yourself, to don't go over the limit. You know, every day you have to think about the second and third week. Like in the first week, don't be too excited. Actually, I've done that pretty well because the team really slowed me down in the beginning. But yeah, with the crash and yeah, I think really bad luck, and also with the poor preparation I had was hard for me.
You'll be back next year.
Yeah, why not on the Vuelta, or maybe, I don't know, but for sure I will be really motivated to do a Grand Tour next year. I had, again, this season was not the best for me. In the winter I was injured, I had like 4 months off instead of one, came back pretty late to racing. It was already like a big achievement for me to be selected with Team Sky, like such a big team on the Grand Tour this year, so for sure this winter I will be super motivated, and yeah, I would really want to do a Grand Tour next year.
So that was Pavel Sivakov. Look out for him in the future. He'll go on to the World Championships, if he, assuming he recovers from some very nasty
riding
wounds.
For?
Russia.
Okay.
Rides for Russia, yeah.
Was it not a point of debate until quite recently, who he was going to ride for, France or Russia?
Or yes, indeed, Italy. He was born in Italy. So, yeah, he could... could ride for...
Where was he born in Italy? I should know this. I've looked this up before. Anyway.
So anyway, here we are in Oviedo. What are we going to do this evening? What are we going to eat tonight? We're actually sitting outside is it an Indian... It's not an Indian restaurant, is it?
No. I mean, Indiana, in Spanish, don't send only mean. Indian, doesn't only go for...
I fancied
Indian
a nice
Americans,
curry.
It's also about the fact that back in the day when Cristobal Colón went on to discover America, he was actually looking for a way to reach the India. So for a while, and it has remained in the Spanish vocabulary, Las Indias is also another way to refer America, the whole continent.
I've got a question, Fran. So we've already been in Asturias on this Vuelta. So we came out of Asturias, went into Castilla y León. Now we're back in Asturias. The other night we had cachopo. We were on the coast. We were the other side. We were the west side of Oviedo and Gijón. Are we still in cachopo country here? And also, what about fabada, which is another big Asturian speciality?
So fabada is very similar to cassoulet. It's about beans, but the kind of meat you put into the fabada is quite different, because in the cassoulet you do this sauté meat.
Confit,
exactly. This confit meat, whereas in fabada you just put everything you may have in mind. But it's quite a heavy dish, you know, and having it at night, it's not good.
But cachopo is also heavy. Explain to us what cachopo is.
Oh, cachopo is basically meat with any kind of cheese and ham you might think of, and all that is marinated and fried.
In breadcrumbs.
In
breadcrumbs.
Well, you had one. You had one each other night, didn't you?
They're huge. They're the size of small continents.
Yeah, they were huge, but they weren't that heavy. I found. Maybe I was very hungry, and since the following morning I went on a run, I didn't feel pretty guilty. So
he knew that we were from the cycling podcast, and he brought us Lionel-sized portions.
Well, let's go and find somewhere. Any suggestions? Do you know? Have you done your due diligence?
Well, we've been here a few times. I know a few spots. And I know a few spots where we could have some cider. I'm not a huge cider fan, to be honest. But in the name of honouring the local specialities, I will, you know, gladly sample it.
In the name of Lionel.
Exactly.
Get your hoodie on then and let's go. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Rich.
Thank you, Fran.
Thank you, Rich. Thank you all.